when she heard the low murmur of voices coming from ahead of her. She raised a warning hand, and Will, instead of bypassing her, slid into cover beside her. She cupped a hand behind her ear, and he pulled his cowl back and turned his head slightly. There it was again, a low murmur, then a sharp burst of laughter. It sounded to be no more than 20 meters away. Will leaned toward her and whispered, "Stay here. I'll take a look." She was content for him to do so. Skilled as she was at silent, unseen movement, Will had the benefit of many more years of experience. He left his bow with her and slipped away from the tree that sheltered them both, moving on his belly in a swift, silent serpent crawl. Maddie waited, staying low, keeping her face and eyes down. She pulled her cowl forward so that her face was in shadow. Lying inert as she was, and concealed beneath her cloak, she wouldn't be spotted unless someone trod on her. She smiled grimly at the thought. That had happened before, and more than once. It was some minutes before Will slid back beside her, his movement barely audible. He didn't speak, but gestured with his thumb for her to follow him, then began to snake his way back the way they had come. She waited half a minute, then followed. After 20 meters or so, Will rose from his belly and, moving in a crouch, continued to ghost his way through the trees. Maddie followed his lead until he stopped, near the point where they had first noticed the smell of wood smoke. They knelt on the ground as he spoke. Even though they were well out of earshot, Will kept his voice low. "It's them, all right. They've got a camp there. The fire is a small one. My guess is that it's a cook fire, but they'll build it up once it's dark. They seem pretty confident. They haven't posted any guards, and they don't seem worried that anyone will have smelled their wood smoke." "Probably not used to being followed," Maddie said. Will nodded. "I suppose that's it. They've been preying on ordinary villagers and farmers for years. I doubt anyone has ever gone after them. People just seem to pay up and take it as part of the cost of life. It's what keeps bandits in business." "Are they all there?" Maddie asked. "Yes, all 8 of them. They're sprawled around the camp. They stole some wine from the tavern last night, and they're all drinking." He smiled fiercely. "That'll be handy for us later." He moved to one side, found a convenient tree, and leaned back against it, pulling his cloak around him. "For now, I'm going to get some rest. You can take the first watch. Wake me in an hour." She smiled to herself as his head dropped onto his chest and he began to breathe deeply and evenly. Vincent and his gang might not bother to set a guard, but that wasn't the ranger way. Darkness fell over the forest. Once the sun had dropped below the treetops, the shadows crept quickly in. There were only occasional glimpses of the stars when Maddie peered up. With Will leading the way, they moved silently through the trees, back toward the camp. In the darkness, there was no need to serpent crawl. They walked carefully, placing their feet delicately and feeling with each step for any twigs or fallen branches that might snap underfoot and give their presence away. Not that there was much chance of that, Maddie thought scornfully, as she listened to the noise coming from the bandits' camp. Their voices were loud and careless, as they talked over one another and shouted each other down. From time to time, they joined in the chorus of a raucous song. Then the singing would die away, and they would laugh loudly. Will caught her eye after one particularly loud chorus and mimed drinking from a glass. The meaning was obvious. The wine they had consumed over the afternoon was having an effect. They had built up the small cooking fire as well. Now the flames rose high among the trees, and the flickering light was visible through the close-set but narrow trunks for 30 meters or so. The two rangers moved closer, still making no sound, and staying in the uneven shadows. As they reached the edge of the small clearing where the camp was situated, Will did a quick count of the figures sprawling and sitting round the fire. He turned to Maddie and held up 8 fingers. All of the band were here. Nobody was on sentry duty. Will pointed to himself, then made a semicircular motion with his hand, ending up pointing to the far side of the clearing. Maddie could tell what he meant, even if they hadn't discussed this before setting out. He was planning to circumvent the camp and approach from the other side. Maddie would stay where she was and provide cover for him if he needed it. And with 8 armed men in the camp, she thought he might. Maddie took stock of her position. She was at the edge of the clearing, and with the darkness of the forest behind her, she was able to move into the open, which gave her room to use her sling. She slung her bow over her left shoulder and loaded a lead shot into the pouch of the sling, letting the leather thongs dangle down from her hand. She nodded once to let Will know she was ready, and he set off, gliding through the trees like a wraith. Even though she was watching him as he set off, she soon found it difficult to see him. Then she realized that she was supposed to be watching the noisy, drunken group around the fire, making sure that none of them had noticed Will moving through the trees. "Not that there's any chance of that," she smiled to herself. When she darted a quick glance in the direction he'd taken, she could see no sign of movement. She set her attention back on the gang of bandits, letting her eyes rove over them, taking care not to stare directly into the glare of the fire, and making sure none of them was about to raise the alarm or reach for a weapon. Vincent was sprawled on the soft ground opposite where she was concealed among the trees. He was propped up against a fallen tree trunk. She noticed his crossbow was close by, already cocked and with a bolt set in place. She sniffed derisively. "Your string's not going to last long if you leave it cocked and loaded all the time," she mentally told the robber chief. Not that Vincent seemed to have any concern in that area. He hoisted himself up against the log so that he was sitting upright, and took hold of a half-full bottle of wine that had been standing on the grass by his elbow. He raised it now in a mock toast. "Here's to our good friend Michel," he said, and the vultures responded with an ironic cheer. "So kind of him to insist on giving us all these bottles of his very finest wine." The drunken group laughed at his words. Several of them had bottles of their own, and they reached for them now to join him in his sarcastic toast. He held his bottle up prior to drinking from it. Will's arrow smashed through it, showering the drunken bandit chief with wine and shattered fragments of glass, before thudding, quivering, into a log lying ready by the fire. Vincent let out a yelp of fear, quickly followed by an angry snarl, as he saw the arrow, and his foggy wits worked out what had just happened. He whirled clumsily around, his hand reaching for the crossbow. "Don't touch it." Will's voice was low, but it carried clearly across the open space of the campsite. Vincent, his night vision blinded by the fact that he'd been staring into the heart of the fire for the past hour or so, squinted and shifted his head from side to side as he tried to make out who had spoken. Whoever it was, he reasoned, was armed. Moreover, the interloper was at an advantage as he could clearly see Vincent, whereas the robber couldn't see him. His hand stopped moving toward the crossbow, and he lurched up onto his knees, still peering into the shadows. The other 7 bandits were silent and frozen in place as well. Then Will stepped out into the clearing, at the fringe of the circle of firelight. He appeared to Vincent's blurred, drunken vision as a spectral, indistinct figure. His face was hidden in the shadows of his cowl, and the cloak, with its irregular pattern and woodland colours, caused him to merge into the background in the flickering firelight, so that one moment he was visible, and the next he seemed to fade away. Vincent felt his muscles freeze with fear. To his superstitious mind, the indistinct figure seemed to be some spirit of the forest, otherworldly and supernatural. The bandit chief opened his mouth to speak, but his throat was dry and no words came. The only distinct thing about the ghostly figure facing him was the massive longbow and the deadly iron warhead that caught the firelight and glittered evilly.
"Who are you?"
he croaked, finally finding his voice. The figure didn't move or reply. Vincent tried again.
"What do you want?"
This time he had more success. That calm, quiet voice replied.
"I want you to pay back the money you stole last night. You picked the wrong village to rob."
There was a growl of anger from the other bandits, and Vincent came up onto one knee. Will had picked the one emotion stronger than the robber's superstitious fear. His greed.
"Pay it back? Why should I pay it back?" he challenged.
"Because if you don't, things will go badly for you." Vincent's mind was working fast, forcing him to think rationally, in spite of the befuddling effects of an afternoon spent drinking. So far, the cloaked figure had threatened, and he had put an arrow through the wine bottle Vincent was drinking from. But he had done Vincent no actual harm. In his place, Vincent would already have shot him, without further warning. Coming to the conclusion that the stranger was unwilling to shoot, he grabbed for the crossbow on the ground beside him and stood, bringing it up to his shoulder, and realized he had made a mistake. Maddie whipped the sling up and over, and the lead shot hissed through the air across the clearing, striking Vincent's skull behind the ear with an ugly thud. The bandit's eyes glazed, and he let out a sickly little moan. Then his knees gave way, and he crashed to the forest floor, stunned. A slow trickle of blood ran down the back of his head.
"I warned you," Will said.
29. It said a lot about Maddie's training and her intelligence that she continued to scan the campsite, watching for any sign of rebellion or danger from the other bandits. 9 out of 10 people in that situation would have had their attention riveted on Will and the fallen bandit leader. But she knew her task was to protect Will, to forestall any attempt to defy him. And with 7 men capable of offering such defiance, the task was an important one. She had already loaded another shot into her sling, and the weapon dangled loosely beside her, swinging gently back and forth, ready for instant action. So while Vincent lay face down and semi-conscious, moaning softly on the forest floor, she kept her gaze moving quickly over the other figures spaced around the campsite. Will himself, trusting in her to cover him, had his attention fixed on the bandit leader. On his right, across the clearing, one of the other bandits was also armed with a crossbow. Out of the corner of his eye, Will saw a flicker of movement as the man rose onto one knee and levelled the crossbow. Maddie saw it too. She realised that Will was a second away from death, and her arm went back, preparing to whip the sling over and send its missile humming across the clearing. But Will was too fast for her. Before she could launch the projectile, his right hand flew to his double scabbard, and in one smooth movement, he drew his throwing knife and sent it spinning across the clearing.
The bandit's hand was beginning to tighten on the trigger when the knife hit him in the centre of his chest. He gave a strangled grunt of pain. Then everything went black for him, and he fell to one side. His hand convulsively squeezed the trigger lever. The crossbow released with an ugly thump, and the bolt flashed upward. Maddie heard it glancing off tree trunks as it went, until it finally lodged in the thick canopy of one of the trees. The rest of the gang was silenced for a moment, staring at his crumpled form. Before they could act, Will's voice cracked out like a whip. "Everybody stay exactly where they are. Anyone who moves, anyone who reaches for a weapon, will get the same treatment from my companion." He nodded toward Maddie, who had moved forward a few more paces and was now standing clear of the trees. Six pairs of eyes now swiveled in her direction. She had replaced the sling with her bow, with an arrow ready nocked, as it was more visually threatening. The sling, after all, looked like two leather thongs hanging from her hand. The bow was a weapon they could recognize, and the iron point of the arrow's warhead gleamed in the firelight. Like Vincent, the bandits had spent the evening staring into the bright light of the campfire, and their night vision was ruined. They saw a dark blur of movement as Maddie trained the bow back and forth across them. "Perhaps you might demonstrate, Matthew," Will said. They had discussed this deception earlier in the evening, before approaching the camp. "We need to subdue them quickly, and that means they have to fear us. If they realize you're a girl," Will had said, "they'll feel a little less threatened." Maddie had opened her mouth to remonstrate, and he raised a hand to forestall her. "You know it's nonsense, and so do I," he said. "But their tiny brains have been conditioned to think like that, so let's not take the risk. Otherwise, we may have to shoot three or four of them to make the point." He'd paused and looked meaningfully at her. She nodded. It was annoying, but she realized he was right. Men like these would not have the intelligence to credit a girl with the skill or courage to face them and defeat them. And Will was right. If they showed any sign of defiance, he and Maddie would probably have to shoot several of them, an outcome neither of them wanted. But now she'd been called on to demonstrate her accuracy and speed, and Will's life wasn't in immediate danger. She shot three times in quick succession. The first shot smashed through another wine bottle, balanced on a tree stump beside one of the gang. As wine and glass splinters exploded in all directions, the man flinched violently away. Before the startled bandits had time to react, Maddie's second shot smacked into the sleeve of a gang member, pinning his right arm to the log he was leaning against. The third arrow buried itself into the soft earth between the knees of a bandit who was sitting with his legs sprawled out. With a shrill cry of fright, he scrabbled his way backward, away from the deadly shaft, even though he was reacting way too late. Will laughed grimly. "Bear it in mind. Anyone who doesn't do exactly as I tell them will be part of a further demonstration. But next time, Matthew won't aim to just miss you." The bandits cast wary, nervous glances toward the indistinct figure who had just shot three arrows in quick succession. There was a clear message here. They were at a complete disadvantage, covered by an archer of fearsome skill, their own weapons well out of reach. These were not fighting men. They were bullies and thieves, used to preying on simple, unarmed farm folk and villagers, striking without warning, using their numbers and their lack of compassion to instill fear into their victims. Now they were confronted by two skilled warriors, warriors who wouldn't hesitate to shoot if they had to. It was not a situation they were familiar with, and it definitely wasn't one they liked. Will paused to let the message sink in, to let them ponder the possible results of any sign of defiance. His next words jerked them back to reality. "We'll start with you in the green shirt," he said. "On your feet. Now." He spat the last word violently as the man hesitated. Slowly the bandit rose to his feet, looking warily around him, not sure what was coming next. He didn't have long to wait before he found out. "All right, strip. Off with your clothes, down to your underwear." Startled by the order, the bandit hesitated further. Will took half a pace forward and drew back on the arrow knocked to his bow. "You have 3 seconds," he said. The bandit responded quickly, stripping off his shirt and trousers so that he was standing, shivering, in just his undershirt and breeches. He watched Will uncertainly, wondering what was coming next. "And your undershirt and boots," the ranger ordered, and the man complied, stripping off his vest, then hopping on one foot as he pulled one boot, then the other, off his feet. The socks that he wore underneath were grubby and tattered. One big toe stuck out through a large hole. "Now lie down, face down on the ground, hands behind your back." The bandit did as he was told. When he was lying in that helpless, vulnerable position, Will leaned his bow against a tree and drew his sacks. Stepping forward and kneeling quickly beside the bandit, he drove the sacks point first into the soft ground, then quickly whipped a pair of leather thumb cuffs around the man's thumbs, pulling the thong tight to secure them. Too late, the bandit tried to struggle against the restraints, but they were firm, and his hands were secured behind his back. Will retrieved his sacks and stood quickly, moving away from the now helpless bandit. He gestured with the big knife to another member of the gang. You with the red cap, on your feet and off with your clothes." The second bandit did as he was told, submitting meekly, then lying face down and allowing Will to tie his hands. Within the space of 10 minutes, Will had 5 of the group stripped, trussed, and helpless, lying face down and shivering in the cold. He ordered the 6th man to strip, then waved him over to where Vincent was still lying on the ground, groaning and crying softly, his wits still scattered by the savage impact of the shot. Blood seeped from the wound, soaking the hair around it. Head wounds usually bled profusely, and this one was no exception. "Bandage him," Will ordered. "Tear up your shirt to do it." The bandit wound strips of his torn shirt around Vincent's head, staunching the flow of blood. Then he helped his leader into a sitting position. Vincent was beginning to regain consciousness, but he was still in a bad way. He stared around the clearing, confused and bewildered, his vision fuzzy and his head throbbing.
"What's happened?"
he asked, his voice thick and indistinct. He frowned as he looked at his companion.
"Is that you, Pierre?"
he asked groggily. Moving swiftly, Will thumb-cuffed Pierre, then Vincent. Will pulled Vincent into a sitting position and, putting his hand under his chin, studied him carefully for several seconds, making sure he wasn't foxing. But he could see Vincent's eyes were wide and unfocused, and he knew that any form of defiance was well beyond him. Then he dragged him and the other bandits to their feet and quickly tied them together with a long cord, passing it around each man's throat. He ran the rope around 4 substantial trees and tied it securely. The black vultures were now fastened in a loose circle around the trees, their hands secured behind them. He gave a satisfied nod as he looked at them, They'd stay this way for hours before they could work their way free. "Gather up their clothes, boots and weapons," he told Maddie, and assisted her in the task. Then he heaved the pile of clothing, boots, and their assorted knives, swords, crossbows and other weapons onto the fire in the middle of the clearing. For a few minutes, the flames died down, and the fire emitted an acrid cloud of smoke. Then, as he piled more brushwood and logs on, the flames flared again. He added their blankets and sleeping bags to the blaze, then more firewood. He watched as the crossbow, spear shafts and axe handles began to burn, and the wood and leather handles of their swords burned away. The blades turned bright red and began to distort, their temper ruined by the intense heat. Will searched the campsite and found a large, heavy sack full of coins. He hefted it over one shoulder. "Looks like the money they stole last night," he told Maddie, "and a bit extra. I'm sure Michelle and his friends will be glad to have it back. Let's be on our way." As he and Maddie turned away from the pathetic group of former brigands, one of them called out, "Wait, you're not leaving us like this?" Will nodded. "Apparently, that's just what we're doing," he said. The bandit tried to plead with him, the effort hindered by the fact that his hands were secured behind his back. "But we'll freeze." Will glanced at the sky, where clouds were once again gathering. "That is a possibility," he said cheerfully. "It does look like there's more rain on the way." "We'll starve," the bandit cried, trying another tack. Will nodded. "That, too, is a distinct possibility. You should have thought of that before you took up a career preying on defenceless villages." He gestured to Maddie and led the way into the forest, heading back to where they had left the horses. The bandits' pleading cries faded as they moved farther away. "He's right, of course," Maddie said. "They could starve." "A prospect that doesn't break my heart," Will replied. "But I doubt it. They'll work their way free in a few hours. They'll be unarmed and helpless. They won't be bothering the villagers again for some time." Maddie was silent for a few minutes. Then she spoke again. "You didn't want to hand them over to the authorities?" Will shrugged. "I don't know who the authorities are. Chances are it's Lassany and his men. If I take in half a dozen criminals to him, it will ruin our cover as jonglers, won't it?" "I suppose so," she said. Then she asked a final question that had been bothering her. "This business of taking away their clothes and boots. I know we've done it before, and I know it makes them more vulnerable and less threatening. But who thought of it in the first place?" Will smiled. "See if you can guess." She paused for a few seconds, then said, "Halt." He nodded once. "Right, first time." 30. Michel Dumont, innkeeper in the mountain village of Entente, was disconsolately raking the fine gravel in the plaza in front of his inn. Vincent and his black vultures had cost him dearly. They had stolen a week's takings from the inn, including the larger-than-usual amount that had gone into his cash box on the night the two jonglers had performed. Fortunately, they hadn't managed to get their hands on his main savings, which were buried in an iron strongbox in the stable yard behind the inn. But still, the loss was a serious one. In addition, the bandits had taken all the ready cash held by the customers at the inn, and that meant that the village would be on short commons for some days. And that, in turn, meant that people would have no money to spend at the inn, until they managed to restore their funds at the next market day, which was 2 weeks away. All in all, things looked grim for the next 10 days or so, and Michel quietly cursed under his breath. Vincent and his gang had robbed the village and the inn before this, but this had been a more serious matter than most. The inn had been full, and most of the villagers had lost money in the raid. So too had the jonglers, he thought gloomily, but he couldn't be too concerned about that. They weren't locals, they weren't his neighbours or friends, and their way of life, travelling alone through the countryside and carrying substantial amounts of money with them, more or less ensured that they would be targeted by robbers from time to time. Still, they had been a pleasant pair and good entertainers, and he felt a degree of sympathy for them. It was particularly bad luck that Vincent had observed the girl storing their takings in the cash box at the back of the cart. They hadn't just lost a night's pay. They had lost everything they had earned in the past week.
Innkeeper!
He started at the voice, which came from behind him. He looked quickly over his shoulder and saw a mounted figure just 10 meters away. Michel, cautious now of strangers, measured the distance to the door of the inn and the long cudgel he kept behind the door. He decided it was too far. The mounted man could ride him down in a few meters, if that were his intention. Still, Michel had something nearly as good at hand. The gravel rake was long and heavy, and its head was studded with a line of large nails. It would make an effective, if clumsy, improvised weapon, if he should need one. He turned and faced the stranger, holding the rake ready in both hands, at an angle across his upper body. The rider clearly recognised his intent.
"You won't be needing that," he said, gesturing at the rake. "I don't wish you any harm."
Michel frowned. There was something familiar about the figure, but it was hard to ascertain what. He was wearing a strange cloak that broke up the outlines of his body, so that Michel had to peer closely at him to focus on him, and his face was hidden in the shadow of his cowl. A massive longbow, strung and ready for use, rested across his thighs. His voice was vaguely familiar, but he spoke with a trace of an accent. Hibernian, Michel realized.
"I think this belongs to you and the rest of your village," the rider said.
As he spoke, he unhitched a heavy sack from the pommel of his saddle and tossed it onto the raked gravel yard. The sack gave off a weighty chink of coin as it hit the ground. Michel started forward, a smile widening on his face as he realized that the villager's fortunes and his own had just been restored. Then, driven by his innate sense of fairness, he hesitated.
"Some of that belongs to a pair of jongleurs who performed here 2 nights ago," he said.
The cowled figure nodded.
"We've already given them their share. We saw them on the road."
Michel nodded, beginning to understand. The jonglers must have encountered this mysterious warrior and his band. After all, he had said, "We saw them," and recounted the story of the robbery at the Entente Inn. Then, for reasons best known to himself, the cloaked rider had decided to wreak vengeance on the Black Vulture gang. Michel didn't know why, and he wasn't about to question the man's motives. He reasoned that the warrior must have a sizable band working for him. After all, he had obviously overpowered the Black Vultures. Had Michel been a more observant man, he might have recognized the shaggy grey horse that the stranger was riding, as one of the 2 horses who had pulled the jongler's cart. But he wasn't a man who took much notice of horses. Cart horses were cart horses, They weren't well-groomed or particularly remarkable. "I'll bid you farewell," said the rider, and turned his horse back the way he had come. "Yes," said Michel uncertainly. He looked down at the bag of coins at his feet. "And thank you, whoever you are." But the rider didn't reply. He tapped his horse with his heels and cantered off down the road leading to Chateau des Falaises. "He didn't recognize you," Maddie said, when Will rejoined her in the trees on the outskirts of the village. He shook his head. "No reason why he should. I'm dressed differently, and I changed my voice. I added a bit of Hibernian accent to it, and he was more interested in the bag of coins that I gave him." He scratched his chin thoughtfully. "You know, he's an honest man, not something you usually find in innkeepers. He told me that some of the money should go to the two jonglers who performed at the inn last night. I said we'd already taken care of them." "So, what do we do now?" Maddie asked. "We'll press on for Chateau des Falaises. It's about a day's ride from here, but I want to leave the cart hidden in the forest along the way." Maddie glanced at him in surprise. "Really? Why's that?" "I've been thinking about it, and it's time we assumed a lower profile. I want to attract less attention. We'll go to the castle as a simple jongleur and his daughter. We won't put on a formal show for Lassenie and his court. We'll play informally for the staff and the garrison in the common rooms. That'll mean we can stay around for a longer period. If we perform for Lassenie in the Great Hall, we'll be hired for one night, and then we'd have to be on our way. This way, nobody will take much notice if we stay for 4 or 5 days, and you'll have a chance to look around while I'm performing." "Look around for what?" Maddie asked, although she was confident she knew the answer. "Not what, who. You can scout around and see where they're holding Philippe's son."
31. They continued on the road leading to Chateau des Falaises. Around the middle of the day, they found a secluded glade some 20 meters off the road. Will carefully guided the cart through the trees until it was in the middle of the glade and well hidden from the road. Maddie unpacked the large net they carried with them to conceal the cart. It was festooned with green and brown strips of cloth, and when it was loosely draped over the cart, it helped it blend into the forest background. She retrieved their bows from the hidden compartment under the cart tray. The bows and the knives they wore in their double scabbards went into a long leather tube, of the kind fishermen used to protect their rods. 2 slender quivers, each holding 15 arrows, were also added. Maddie indicated the knives. "We already have knives," she said. Each of them was wearing a sax in a simple scabbard, and had a throwing knife in a concealed spot as well. Will glanced up. "Doesn't hurt to have spares," he said. "Our knives might be confiscated when we go into the castle." While Maddie was rigging the camouflage net over the cart, Will set about transforming his jongleur's outfit. He selected the second best outfit and smeared it with dirt and dust from the road. Then he sewed several unmatching patches onto the jerkin, so that it looked old and worn. Maddie glanced across as he was doing this. "What's that for?" she asked. He paused to bite off a length of thread from his latest patch. "As I said, I want to keep a low profile. With the cart and its decorations and your equipment, we look like top-of-the-line performers. The sort who would seek to appear in the castle lord's hall. This way, we look a little down at heel and raggedy Andy, as if we'll be glad to sing for our supper in the common rooms of the castle, without bothering the quality folk." He said quality with a slight sneer. He believed Lassigny to be anything but. When he had finished, his smart, brightly coloured jongler's outfit was transformed into a rather dull, stained and patched version of its former self. Maddie had donned a plain outfit as well, a green jerkin over brown leggings. She left her ranger cloak tied behind her saddle and wore a waist-length cape made of grey wool. Will eyed her approvingly. "Just the thing," he said. Then he spread his arms to display his stained, patched tunic, the once bright colours now dulled by dirt and some grease from the cart's axle. "How do I look?" Maddie eyed him with disapproval. "Like I shouldn't be seen travelling with you," she said at length. Will took the cash box from the back of the cart and buried it beneath a tree with a distinctive fork 2 metres from the ground. Then he marked the trunk with 2 parallel slashes from his sacks. Easy enough to find again, but not so conspicuous as to catch the eye of a casual observer. "Be a pity if someone stumbled on the cart and decided to steal it," he said. "Along with all our earnings to date." Then they mounted and rode out of the little clearing, continuing down the mountain road to Lassigny's chateau. Chateau des Falaises was named for the steep cliffs that tumbled away below it on all sides, falaise being the Gallic word for cliff. It was set on a rocky outcrop rising out of a lake. A raised causeway, some 8 metres high and 40 metres in length, connected it to the shores of the lake. The causeway was steep-sided and unfenced. It started out wide enough for 8 or 9 people to walk abreast. But as it snaked toward the castle entrance, it narrowed considerably. By the time it reached the castle, there was barely room for 4 people to stand side by side. The situation for those traversing the causeway was made more precarious by the fact that the edges were unsealed and had crumbled away at several points, so that it looked as if a giant had taken huge bites out of the edge of the path. At the base of the cliffs, to the left of the causeway, their attention was taken by a flock of gulls, screaming and wheeling in the sky over a pile of rubbish, obviously dumped from the castle high above. Will sniffed disdainfully. "I imagine that gets pretty ripe in hot weather," he said. The castle itself was a fairly standard design. After the graceful beauty of La Lumière and Araluen castles, it was disappointingly plain, but it was solidly built and would be difficult to assault, even without the awkward approach path formed by the causeway. There were 4 main towers, joined by curtain walls that reached halfway up each, the whole structure forming a square. The towers were surmounted by turrets that jutted out past the width of the tower itself, and were enclosed by crenellated walls to form defensive positions. The design allowed defenders to shoot missiles or drop rocks and stones on attackers clustered round the base of the towers. A massive gatehouse, containing the operating mechanism for a heavy iron portcullis, guarded the entrance to the castle. It was fitted with a fighting platform that provided room for more defenders, giving them a vantage point from which they could rain missiles down on enemies clustered around the heavy gates. Inside the square, formed by the towers and the curtain wall, stood a 5th building. Wider and lower than the corner towers, it was a squat, solidly built structure that stood several stories higher than the curtain wall. Its roof was flat, and the wall running round the roof was also crenellated, providing a further defensive line. This was the keep, the central building of the chateau, where the staff and garrison were housed and fed. The higher levels would be devoted to administrative offices for the castle hierarchy, and private apartments for the castle lord and his senior advisers and officers. It was also the refuge of last resort, in the event that the outer walls were breached and an enemy gained entry to the chateau. A steady stream of traffic moved across the causeway to the chateau's gates. About half were pedestrians, some pushing handcarts, but there was a fair representation of people on horseback, and carts drawn by horses and donkeys as well. A mixed stream of goods made its way into the castle. Sides of beef and sheep carcasses, vegetables, firewood, casks of ale and wine. Some carts were loaded with wooden cages of ducks and chickens. Each cart or traveller would be stopped at the gate, examined and questioned, then allowed to pass through the gate into the courtyard. As the carts reached the narrow end of the causeway, they moved with extra caution, the drivers ensuring that the wheels stayed well clear of the crumbling edges of the path. A team of 8 or 9 soldiers, armed with short swords and long-shafted halberds, conducted the examination of would-be visitors to the chateau. As Will and Maddie watched the steady procession, they saw nobody turned away. "That looks promising," Maddie said. Will grunted. "So far, so good." They had drawn rein on a small hill overlooking the start of the causeway. Now they urged their horses forward and found a gap in the stream of traffic moving toward the castle. It took them some time to traverse the path, with the constant interruptions to the traffic flow caused by the interrogation and inspection of each person or group looking to enter the castle. Finally, it was their turn. One of the soldiers motioned them inside, leaving room for a cart full of sides of freshly slaughtered beef to be inspected outside the gate. They clip-clopped through the dim interior of the gatehouse, then out into the bright sunlight again, where the soldier motioned for them to stop. He eyed Will's grubby finery, noting the leather mandola case strapped to his saddle bow.
"Jongleur, are you?" he asked.
Will smiled. "Yes, sir. I'm a musician, and this is my young daughter who's travelling with me." The soldier frowned as he noted Will's accent.
"Where from?"
"Araluin, sir. We've been travelling in this country for a month." Will had dropped the Hibernian accent he had assumed for Michelle at the inn.
"And what do you want here?"
the soldier asked. He was only half interested. It was fairly obvious what the down-at-heel performer would be looking for, but he had to go through the motions.
"I was hoping for food and lodgings for a few days, sir. I'll be happy to perform for the castle staff in return."
"Why not stay at the inn in the village?" the soldier demanded.
The village protected by the castle was a quarter of a kilometre back along the road. Will hesitated, looking embarrassed.
"It's only a small village, sir. Not many to entertain, and the inn is rather expensive."
The soldier gave a harsh laugh. He knew the local innkeeper's parsimonious reputation.
"I imagine it is."
He glanced at the long leather tube, strapped upright behind Will's saddle.
"What's in there?" he demanded.
"Fishing rods and reels, sir," Will told him.
The soldier frowned a warning.
"All fish in the lake and rivers in this fief are property of the baron. There's no fishing for strangers."
"Of course, sir."
Will bowed from the waist in acknowledgement.
"I understand. No fishing."
The soldier eyed them for a few seconds, then shrugged.
"Very well," he said.
"You'll have to get the seneschal's approval. His office is on the 3rd floor of the keep. Leave your horses at the itching post there."
He indicated a weathered post set into the cobblestones of the courtyard, a few metres from the entrance to the keep. Will bowed again and urged Tug forward.
"Come along, daughter," he said, and led the way inside the castle yard. The seneschal, the knight responsible for the administration of the castle and its staff, questioned them briefly. Then he gave permission for them to take up two sleeping spaces. These were curtained-off recesses set around the walls of the great hall and the other common rooms of the castle. The lower-ranking castle staff, servants, kitchen hands and cleaners, slept there, as did casual visitors. 4 coppers a day, he told them briskly. That'll give you 2 meals a day, a cold breakfast and a hot supper, and a sleeping space each. Fresh straw every 2 days. How long did you plan on staying?
Perhaps a week, sir, Will said.
The man nodded, eyeing Will's clothing.
I assume you'll be performing?
Yes, sir, with your permission, Will told him. The seneschal thought for a moment.
Very well. I'll make it 3 coppers a day. That's 21, but we'll round it down to 20. If you decide to stay longer, come and see me again.
Will paid him and received 2 round leather medallions in return, with numbers burned into the leather. 82 and 83. They're your sleeping spaces, the seneschal said. Your horses can go into the stables. They're on the eastern wall of the courtyard. But you look after them yourselves.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Will bowed several times. But the seneschal had lost interest in them already. He dismissed them with a brusque wave of his hand as he pulled a stack of invoices toward him. 32. They led the horses to the stables, which were in a 2-story building set against the curtain wall on the eastern side of the castle bailey. The upper story was clearly a hayloft. There was a hoisting beam and pulley set in a wide double doorway, by which bales of hay could be lifted up and stored. The ground floor was a long, dimly lit building, lined with horse stalls on either side. Just over half of them were occupied, and the 2 new arrivals were met by a 12 or so curious noses peering over the stall doors as they clopped inside the building. The stable master greeted them as they entered. He was a surly-looking man, thin as a rake, and with a head cold that had him sniffing constantly. He eyed the 2 new arrivals and their apparently unimpressive horses.
"What do you want?"
he demanded, although Maddie thought the answer was pretty obvious. Will, however, maintained a subservient tone as he replied. There was no need to antagonize the man. He knew from long experience that people like this, with their own little domain and sense of self-importance, could be tyrants if not treated properly.
"The seneschal said we could stable our horses here, sir," he said.
"Did he now? And I suppose he expects me to look after them for you, does he?"
the man challenged. Will spread his hands in a placating gesture.
"No, sir. He said we should look after them ourselves. We're happy to do that."
"So you should be. I don't have time to be chasing after a pair of shaggy nags like these 2,
the stable master said. Behind Maddie, Bumper raised his head and snorted indignantly. She quieted him with a quick touch of her hand.
"Put them in 2 of the stalls at the back there."
The stable master waved a vague hand at the row of unoccupied stalls at the rear of the long, low room.
"They can share 1 stall, Will told him. "They're small horses, and they're used to each other's company."
"How lovely for them. Well, that's your choice, but you'll still pay for 2. There's water in the trough there, and hay and oats for them. 1 bin of oats every 3 days, he added shrewdly.
Will shrugged in acknowledgement. "And that'll be 6 copairs for their feed for the week," the man said. There was a challenging note in his voice, as if he were waiting for Will to dispute the price. Will looked at him for a long moment. He was sure that the cost of the horse's feed was covered by the fee he was paying the seneschal, but there was no point in arguing. "Of course," he said. He rummaged in his belt purse for the 6 coppers and handed them over. Perversely, the surly stablemaster looked a little disappointed, as if he had expected an argument. He waved a hand toward the stalls, and they led the horses into the long building. They settled the horses into a stall, filling the feed bin with hay and the drinking trough with fresh water. Will leaned the bow case against the wall in the shadows at the back of the stall. Tug and Bumper would prevent anyone from looking at it more closely. Then, carrying their saddlebags and their rolled ranger cloaks and bedding, Will and Maddie headed for the keep. Maddie waved goodbye to the stablemaster, who was repairing a harness. He scowled in reply. "Friendly type," she said to Will as they emerged into the afternoon sunlight in the courtyard. He shook his head. "Before we leave, I might take the time to smack him over the ear," he said. Maddie smiled at the thought. "I'd pay you 6 coppers to see that," she said. The common room on the ground floor of the keep was where they would eat and sleep while they were here. The vast room, set with tables and benches, could seat between 50 and 70 people, the less important members of the castle staff. The sleeping spaces were set in niches around the walls, each with room for a straw-filled mattress, and with hooks set into the wall to hang clothes and belongings. A waist-high wooden platform served as a bed. It was covered with a thinly packed straw mattress and a coarse linen pillow. The spaces were curtained off from the main room to provide a modicum of privacy for the occupants. They found their allotted spaces and spread their bedding out on the straw mattresses. Will studied his and sniffed it once or twice. "Seems clean enough," he commented. They concealed their saxes under the bedding. Their throwing knives were in concealed sheaths, Will's strapped to his left forearm and Maddie's inside the back of her collar. Will had shaken his head when she had selected that hiding place.